getting real food to the people of Homs today, Tuesday, February 11th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. UN officials are shocked at the deprivation and destruction they're encountering in the besieged Syrian city of Homs.
There's not a single building, not one structure, which hasn't been affected by the fighting. 600 days of siege means that it is destroyed.
We'll hear how much aid is getting in and what's happening to residents who've gotten out in recent days. And later, why so many Olympic athletes come from one nation but represent another. And how Irish author Roddy Doyle gets into his character's head.
You know, when you write about working class people, and you're never far from the fridge.
Plus, a new cafe in London where the coffee and biscuits are free, but you pay for the time.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The expression hell on earth is probably overused, but if you listen to eyewitnesses who are in Homs, Syria's third largest and embattled city, that's exactly what it sounds like.
You're looking at a place that is rather like Stalingrad in 1942. There's not a single building, not one structure, which hasn't been affected by the fighting.
That's Matthew Hollingworth. He's a Syria country director for the World Food Program, and he's been in Homs since Friday. That's when a tenuous ceasefire went into effect, allowing some humanitarian aid to get in and some residents to get out. Hollingworth says Homs is a city in ruins.
600 days of siege means that it is destroyed. People are living in basements. They are crawling through tunnels between buildings, living an existence and nothing more than that.
Who's left in Homs? I mean, how many people are still there and how many people are fleeing?
So far, 1,100 or more than 1,100 people have come out through the evacuation process this last week. There are double that left behind. We're going to try and continue the evacuation for those that want to choose to come out. But, you know, there are certainly a lot more people left.
They're staying behind because there is just no way for them to get out? Are any of them staying behind because they want to stay?
There are people that don't want to leave, you know, people that don't want to leave their homes, their ancestral homes. But there are also many disabled people who are, you know, sick or not able-bodied to get out easily. And there are others that are frightened to come out, but, you know, are looking now at potentially taking the leap because the situation is just so desperate inside. But again, we've seen a lot more people come out than anybody imagined.
Yeah, and with this desperation, Matthew, has the evacuation been mostly orderly or chaotic?
There's been moments of chaos and there's been other moments of order. We continued the evacuation process despite some fairly high-profile breaches of the ceasefire. And at those times, it was certainly chaotic. The last pullout of people yesterday was actually a lot more orderly. But then again, that's because people had seen it work and they'd seen the success of the operation over the days previously.
Matthew, can you give us a description of just what it looks like, these people who have been basically burrowed into their apartment buildings for almost 3 years and now emerging to you guys and buses? I mean, what are they taking with them? How do they look?
Everybody's a bag of bones, to be honest. You're looking at people that certainly for the last few months, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, have had very little food. I've met, you know, little children that when we give them a meal when they first come out, they don't recognize an apple. They don't know what a banana is. They've never seen fresh fruit. People haven't eaten meat for 2 years or more. It really is shocking, the level of deprivation that people have lived through.
What are the actual logistics of giving food to these people? I mean, for kids who don't even recognize a banana, are they able to hold food down at this point?
We've got medical personnel on hand when they first come out. We've got psychosocial support when people come out. For those who have been mentally affected by the situation they've been living in, they certainly have had a couple of interesting first nights out of the city. It's a lot quieter. There's no fighting. It's a lot more comfortable, and food's available to them that they haven't had access to for many, many months now.
Finally, Matthew, how visible are rebel or army fighters in the streets of Homs?
In Old Homs, you certainly do see opposition fighters above ground. Civilians are a lot more careful in coming out. But in saying that, when we spent 8 hours in Homs 2 days ago, we met a lot of people, certainly a lot more than people expected. And people came out to see us specifically because we're the first people that have come in for a long time.
The UN's Matthew Hollingworth in Homs. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
While the ceasefire in Homs has allowed hundreds of residents to evacuate, some haven't made it very far. About 300 men and boys have been detained by government forces. That's because the government says they're of potential fighting age, between 15 and 55. Their detention has alarmed UN humanitarian officials who helped broker the ceasefire. Melissa Fleming is a spokesperson for the UN's refugee agency.
UNHCR is there monitoring the whole situation. And in fact, it was known that they would question the men who were not part of the deal. The deal that was agreed between the government and the opposition was that the evacuation would include women and children and those who are over, men who are over 55 and under 15. So many people took the opportunity to escape the besieged city of Homs when our cars went in and our vans went in and our buses went in, that what emerged was that there were a number, over 300 of men who did not meet that criteria and who are now being questioned by Syrian authorities in a school. Several have been released and they're being taken to parts of the city that where we can deliver aid.
So if that deal was between the Assad government and the opposition, did the UN and the UNHCR have problems with it?
UNHCR and the UN were very much aware of the deal. We were pleased to have any opportunity to access the besieged old city of Homs. People cut off from any form of aid for almost 2 years, and to provide the opportunity for people to escape, to leave, to be evacuated from the city. These people were on the verge of starvation, and we were shocked at their condition. They were in a state of health that was really, really troubling. Kids were traumatized, and people were eating grass and weeds and thyme. And it was just high time that these people got out so that we could treat them as best we could. We hope that every civilian who wants to be evacuated or every civilian who needs humanitarian assistance will be able to receive it due to this humanitarian pause that will last a few more days.
So the UN accepted this deal knowing the risks that possibly some men and boys might be pulled aside, but realizing that if you did nothing, it could be worse?
We're in a war situation, and our role is as a neutral body to reach people in need of aid with humanitarian assistance. Up in many places of Syria, this has not been possible. This is hugely disturbing to us. We have a couple more days of ceasefire, and we're very much hoping that all civilians who want to leave the city have the opportunity to do so. They're in a desperate state.
And Melissa, what can you tell us about what's happening to those males in that school? Are they being questioned?
There's a procedure where they're being screened and questioned, and some of them have gone through the procedure, and they've then been free to leave. Many of them have moved to a part of the outskirts of Homs where UNHCR, UNICEF, other organizations will follow up. We've been able in the school to talk to these people separately and to assess their particular needs, their health needs. Many of them, for example, have come with their wives and their children. They just didn't want to be separated.
Have your people on the ground been able to tell you what kind of things are being asked and why they're being questioned?
This is something that, no, I'm not going to get into that, sorry.
Can you tell us why they're being questioned, though?
They're being questioned to determine the nature of their role inside the city.
But, I mean, if these men and boys are being questioned, certainly the UNHCR has some worries about where that could lead.
UNHCR is in, as our UNICEF, are monitoring the situation in the school.
Melissa Fleming, spokesperson with the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
A man in Tibet set himself on fire last week. He reportedly died from his injuries. This appears to be the first Tibetan self-immolation this year, but it's not likely to be the last. More than 120 Tibetans have set themselves on fire in recent years to protest China's rule over the region. Getting information out of Tibet isn't easy either. But as the World's Matthew Bell reports, there's a Tibetan in Beijing who's made it her mission to do just that.
Her name is Tsering Use. She's in her late 40s, and she writes poetry and commentaries. She grew up in Tibet, but these days she lives in the Chinese capital. When I met Use in Beijing, she had just returned from a three-month trip to Tibet. On her mind were the new restrictions on Tibetans visiting the holy city of Lhasa. People were forced to give up their ID cards, she said, and stay in designated areas. I never thought this kind of segregation would be imposed on us, Use says. It's like South Africa under apartheid. She says these kinds of policies help explain the self-immolations. Use has done a lot of reporting on these protests since they began in 2009. Last year, she published a book that profiles those Tibetans who've set themselves on fire. I'm a Tibetan, she tells me, and I want to explain why Tibetans continue to self-immolate as a form of political protest. They are suffering a lot, she says, and the world has kept silent. In addition to her books, Use is a prolific blogger, but interestingly, she writes in Chinese. That makes her a unique voice for Tibetans, says Elliot Sperling from Indiana University's Tibetan Studies program.
There's a tendency among many people who are interested in Tibet to tend to see Tibet as frozen in this sort of idealistic Buddhist or even folk kind of culture, but all culture is dynamic.
Sperling says Use embodies this dynamism. Other Tibetan intellectuals are also doing this from afar. They live in the West and write in English.
But Use really represents this within the People's Republic of China. In other words, she represents somebody who is very much engaged in the modern world.
That brings big challenges because Tibet is a highly sensitive issue for the Chinese government. Beijing says the rights of Tibetans are protected in China, and that the government has gone out of its way to help develop Tibet's economy and preserve its unique culture. Most of the Chinese public buys that line, which makes Tsering Use's work even more vital, says Tenzin Tetong. He's a former cabinet member of the Tibetan government in exile, now working for Radio Free Asia in Washington.
Maybe this is the one area where the Tibetan story is least understood. A vast majority of the Chinese public have had a very general understanding that since Tibet became part of the PRC, Tibetan life has improved dramatically for the better. And when in reality, there are very, very serious issues still going on.
For her work writing about those issues, Tsering Use got some recognition from Secretary of State John Kerry last year.
Tibet has become increasingly identified with self-immolations and protests against the deteriorating human rights condition for China's Tibetan citizens.
But when Kerry announced the winners of the International Women of Courage Awards, Use could not attend the ceremony. She was under house arrest in Beijing, which for her is a recurring nuisance. Use continues to publish books outside of China and to blog. She's also got more than 47,000 followers on Twitter. But is she getting Chinese people's attention, I ask? I've been writing about Tibet issues for so many years, Use tells me. I think there is some effect. You just have to keep repeating the truth, she says, and eventually people will start to listen. Besides, what else is there to do? For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Beijing.
This is PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Imagine if Kobe Bryant decided to go back to the Olympics, but instead of representing the U.S., he played hoops for Italy. That'd be weird. Well, that's kind of what's happening now in Sochi with Korean speed skater An Hyun-soo. He just won a bronze medal at the Games, but not for his home country of South Korea. He's representing Russia now as Viktor An, which makes him a so-called passport Olympian. That's a phrase I learned from Jim Capel, senior writer for ESPN.com. He's in Sochi right now, actually in the mountains of Krasnaya Polyana, the venue for Olympic alpine events. Capel says passport Olympians can be found at the Summer Olympics, too, but they're easier to notice at the Winter Games.
You hear, oh, there's somebody from the Virgin Islands who's a skier, and you think, wow, that gets your attention. Or there's somebody from Zimbabwe who's skiing. I'm not sure if we see it more. I think it just stands out more because you just assume, oh, if you're from an equatorial country or from someplace in Africa, you're just not going to be a Winter Olympian. But it does happen.
So what are the rules within the International Olympic Committee for athletes with dual nationalities and what countries they're supposed to or can represent?
Well, it varies a bit. It depends on the sport. Some sports, if you compete in the Olympics for one nation, you are never allowed to compete for another nation in the Olympics. Other sports don't have that rule. And then it's also a matter of what is your citizenship? What is your ancestry? A lot of times it'll be my parents are from this country or my grandparents are from my country. And then if the country will allow you to compete for them, then you can.
And since some countries are trying to go for medal dominance, do champion athletes like a Bodie Miller or a Shaun White, do they care about this added level of competition with the passport Olympians?
I don't think it really affects them too much. There's going to be very, very few athletes who are going to do this, who will challenge the top contenders anyway. And if they are that good, well, they've got to beat them anyway somehow.
Mm. Now, Jim, our listeners will obviously know about figure skaters with Russian heritage competing for the U.S., but I gather there are actually examples of U.S. citizens competing for Russia in these games.
Yes, there's Vic Wild, who is a snowboarder, who's, again, from I'm from the state of Washington. He's from the state of Washington. He married another Russian athlete, and he is going to compete for Russia this year. And then on the flip side, we've got Simon Shapir, who was born in Russia but moved to the United States when he was very, very young. Grew up in Boston, has a very thick Boston accent, and will be representing the Americans in Paris figure skating.
You know, somewhere in this discussion is a whole nother discussion to be had about identity in the Olympics, you know, with more and more people with dual and even quadruple identities and hyphenated last names. Do you think the Olympics is kind of on the verge of facing a larger debate about who is really from what country anymore?
I don't think so. I think it's always going to be a part of the Olympics, but I think it's always going to be a fairly small part of it. The issue is there are sometimes countries might be willing to make it worth, and when money comes into it, then it becomes a bit more of a thorny issue. And if that becomes more prevalent, if it becomes more of an issue, I think we might see the IOC trying to crack down more on it. But usually this is simply a case of athletes trying to fulfill Olympic dream, countries trying to fulfill an Olympic dream, and nobody loses, everybody wins, although they probably don't win a medal.
Jim Capel, senior writer for ESPN.com. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
How about some free coffee? Sound good, right? Free cookies, too. Yeah, there's now a coffee shop in London that offers both. And I hear you ask, how do they make any money? Well, they charge you for the time you spend there, eating, drinking, and updating your social media status. Wait, huh? Well, we sent reporter Russell Newlove to check out Zifferblatt's for this week's Sideways Glance.
Time, they say, is money. And at Zifferblatt, a new cafe in London's trendy East End, they feel the same. The coffee and food are free, but time will cost you. 3 pence a minute, about $3 an hour.
Hello.
Okay, hello. My first time here.
It is, yeah.
Zifferblatt, Russian for clock face, might be the first of its kind in the UK, but it's an established idea in Russia. Its founder is Ivan Mitin, a mustachioed man from Moscow with a tendency to philosophize.
Zifferblatt is something like a treehouse for grown-ups where anyone is really open to each other when they don't wear the masks that society forces us to wear in a big city.
Thought-provoking. But essentially, it's a coffee house. It started out in Moscow as a venue for poetry readings, art shows and the like, relying solely on donations to pay rent. As it grew in popularity and the rent increased, Ivan had to impose a minimum donation. Zifferblatt became known as a pay-per-minute cafe space.
You can sit and work here with your computer. You can draw pictures, as this lady do. You can read a book, you can invite for your friends, or you can meet someone new and have a chat with him. And everything is for free here, except time people spend.
London is notoriously expensive, so when word got out that the cafe was giving away free tea and biscuits, cynics were quick to consider exploiting it. Why spend $4 at Starbucks when you could get as much as you like for pennies at Zifferblatt?
The key difference between Zifferblatt and your standard coffee chains is that they are not treating you just like someone they want to get money out of.
Alexi Duggins is editor of Time Out London, and if he likes a place, there's a good chance that place will do well, at least for a while.
It's really significant that they don't call you customers, they call you micro-tenants, because they want people to be there and share the space and use it in a way that they feel comfortable with.
So far, micro-tenants are plentiful. Students without their own living rooms, telecommuters, people who don't like the dark appeal of local pubs, shoppers in need of a relaxing space, they're all here.
It's quite nice to be able to just come here and sit and chat and it not be invading anyone else's space. You don't feel the pressure to leave, unlike other cafes where they're like, here's the bill, leave now.
I think this is a lovely idea, a social place. You can interact with people, you can have a drink and a toast and relax. And we need it so badly. I think every corner should have something like this.
But look, if he's giving everything away for free, how is he making any money? Ivan's vague, but confident his formula works.
The price of tea bags or beans is not that high. And by giving it for free, we are not. It's not like we are giving gold here, or so. It's not that big problem.
A quick look at what the cafe offers confirms that: cut rate tea bags, supermarket brand cookies, coffee beans bought in bulk, simple things. And it's mostly self serve. If you want a luxurious caramel macchiato, you've got to make it yourself.
We are a secret space hidden on the first floor. With no sign, like, come here and drink as much as you can for 3 p.m. And people who comes here, they already know why do they come here. And they don't try to use it, like, you know, let me drink 10 cappuccinos in 10 minutes and die here.
And with around 10 branches of his own in Russia and numerous copycats opening up nearby, Ivan is sure that the rest of the world is open to the idea.
London is really expensive, and that was one of the challenges why we choose this city, because if it will work here, then we will work everywhere.
For The World, I'm Russell Newlove in London.
You're listening to The World on Public Radio International and on PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Shirley Temple Black, the diplomat. How the former child star witnessed history unfold as U.S. ambassador to Czechoslovakia. Plus, writer Roddy Doyle on music and memory.
I am a firm believer that music is almost like a channel or a thread right the way back to childhood.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Let me take you back for a moment to 1989. The Velvet Revolution is unfolding in the country then known as Czechoslovakia. The Soviet bloc is slowly crumbling. Now, you may have heard many things today about the late Shirley Temple Black, her blonde curls, that dimple, her tap dancing. But what you may not know is that she was not too far from those historic demonstrations in the streets of Prague as U.S. ambassador to Czechoslovakia from 1989 to 1992.
It's really been history in the making. And after the things that have happened in East Germany and also in Bulgaria, I wouldn't be surprised by anything that happens.
That's Ambassador Shirley Temple Black speaking there. Michael Zentofsky is a current Czech ambassador to Britain. He worked with the former child actress on several occasions. Thanks so much for joining us for a few minutes, Ambassador. What was your reaction today when you heard the news that Shirley Temple Black had passed away?
I was very saddened. I knew Shirley Temple Black quite well, both in her ambassadorial capacity when I was the spokesman for President Havel, but also before the Velvet Revolution in 1989, and after she retired from the diplomatic service when I was the ambassador to the United States and she retired to Woodside, California.
What were your interactions like? She had already been in Ghana as ambassador, but here she comes into Czechoslovakia, and she's an American Republican appointee. What was she like during this time?
I would say she was inimitable. I mean, she was not standard career diplomat by any stretch of the imagination, but she had a very friendly personality and very lively personality as well. So it felt very easy and good to be around her.
And being there in this very kind of chaotic time in the history of Czechoslovakia and, you know, Cold War is about to end, I mean, what did Czechoslovakians think of her?
She had been in Prague for about 4 months when the revolution started. And already before the revolution, she sympathized quite openly with the opposition movement. So after the Velvet Revolution, she became, of course, very popular and one of the architects of a new relationship between Czechoslovakia then and the United States.
I mean, it's kind of wild. A child star, and suddenly she's witness to a revolution. Was she impatient that the Eastern Bloc wasn't kind of melting fast enough?
She had a history, actually. She happened to be in Czechoslovakia on the night of the 20th of August 1968, which was the night when the Soviet armies invaded Czechoslovakia at the end of the Prague Spring. She was there for an unrelated event, a conference on multiple sclerosis. But she already was slightly familiar with the country and also with its political issues. The cables that the U.S. Embassy in Prague sent to Washington in the second part of 1989 show a certain impatience with the slowness of the developments in then Czechoslovakia. Actually, 2 weeks before the revolution took place, one of the cables basically says that Czechoslovaks are too risk averse and that they are quite happy about the situation and nothing is going to happen anytime soon. And 2 weeks later, it certainly happened. But that happens to all diplomats. Our crystal balls are faulty.
As a child film star, Shirley Temple was pretty well known in the Soviet Union and its satellites. Did you find in your own interactions with Shirley Temple Black a kind of your own desire, a curiosity to find out more about her life as a child star?
I wish I could say that I was, but I think I missed out on the Shirley Temple Black child star phenomenon. It was my parents' generation who were very familiar. We were the generation of the 60s, so Presley and the Beatles were more of our kind of thing. But certainly I did know who she was, and I did know that she was a famous child actress.
What will be for you kind of the most memorable time you spent with her?
We had a very nice weekend with her, with my then wife and her husband, Charlie Black, in California when we came to visit her in the early 90s. And so this was one time when we had a lot of time for idle conversation and for relating some of the stories we experienced together. And we had a ball. I mean, that's how I will remember her. Very lively, very friendly, and a friend of my country.
Michael Zentofsky is the ambassador from the Czech Republic to the UK. He's been speaking with us about the late Shirley Temple Black. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
On the good ship, Lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach of Peppermint Bay.
Little Curly Top, still adorable, 80 years on. For our next story, we're taking you to Spain, where for the past 6 months, people have been obsessed with a TV drama about a seamstress. And I kid you not, it actually set off a sewing renaissance among Spaniards. The World's Jerry Haddon introduces us to The Time Between Seams.
My name is Sira Quiroga, and I'm a seamstress. I never imagined that destiny would lead me to risk my life crossing a foreign city with an arsenal of pistols strapped to my body. But now I know that destiny is the sum of all the decisions we make in our lives. For me, it all began with something as simple as learning to thread a needle.
Hooked? Join the club. The Time Between Seams turned out to be the most popular TV drama in Spanish history. Nearly 5 million viewers, more than a quarter of TV watchers in Spain. It's a full-blown period drama set in Spain, Morocco, and Portugal during and after the Spanish Civil War. The show just ended, but it's left a living legacy. This is a sewing supply store called The Spider's Web, the biggest in Valencia. In the back, gathered around a table, about a dozen women sew, darn, and stitch during a free workshop. In one corner, there's Laura, a young pharmacist who's converting an old dress into a new skirt. She says she decided to learn how, thanks to the fictional seamstress from TV. I like her character, she says. It awoke something in me, something that you normally associate with the older generation, with grandmothers. Now it's becoming fashionable to sew among young women. At a nearby table, 29-year-old Victoria Romero is finishing up a handbag, stitching a seam by hand. I just loved all the designs that Sira made, she says. And the story, of course, is really interesting too, but the dresses, they were really impressive. Women's clothes today have lost that femininity. Women were more feminine back then. This is the new, brand new generation of Spanish seamstresses. And it's growing by the week, says the owner of the Spider's Web, Maria Jose Manioc. In workshops like these and online via popular blogs, Facebook pages, there's even talk of an exhibition in Madrid of the dresses Sira the seamstress designed on the show. Now if they'd only start a TV show about needlework or crocheting, laughs Manioc, her business would really be booming. As has been business on Amazon.es, the Spanish branch of the online giant. The company recently said that it's seen about a 150% spike in sewing machine sales each and every Monday as the series aired. Some have said this is a sign that Spain's tattered economy is turning a corner. You know, more people spending on pricey items. But the women at the Spider's Web workshop say just the opposite is true. People are simply looking for ways to make their old clothes last longer, to feel more self-sufficient, even as they have less money. In Spain, it turns out, even the sewing machine vendors are having a rough time. Amazon's success, says Juan Galdón, is his loss. Galdón sits in his cluttered sewing machine store with his arms crossed, waiting for customers and waiting. Booming sales, I ask him?
No.
No? You know, because of the TV series, I say. Sira. I didn't watch it, he says. Didn't interest me. A lot of vendors who come in make the same comment, he says. Hey, you must be selling more machines because of that show. But it's not true. The crisis has hit hard here, he says. I guess the online stores are selling more because they sell at such low prices. The only uptick Galdón says he's seen is in repairs, a further sign that people are hanging on to what they have.
Listen.
Which is ultimately what Sira, the seamstress heroine, does without giving too much away. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Valencia, Spain.
I've got a sewing machine, but to be honest, I don't use it. Kind of like the newspaper. I still get one of those delivered, but often I barely touch it because I've read the same articles online the day before. Newspapers all over the globe know what I'm talking about, and some are coming up with some creative, perhaps desperate ways to survive. Take the venerable French newspaper Libération.
They want to kick the journalists out of their headquarters in the center of Paris, which is located in a very nice building, I must say. And they want to turn it into a luxury restaurant and facilities for entertainment surrounding the information world.
That's former Libération editor Pierre Asky. He says journalists at the paper are not happy.
They feel that creating excitement around the brand without investing in the news side of it and without a real plan to save and rescue the newspaper itself is really focusing on business, on trendy business, and not on what a newspaper is first meant to be.
I mean, the shareholders of Libération voted on this. So do they understand the business of journalism?
The newspaper fortunes have gone down in the past few years, and today the newspaper is still losing a lot of money. And its previous shareholder, main shareholder, Mr. Rothschild, the famous banker family, has been joined by a new shareholder who's a real estate developer. And he's the one who at the moment is designing this new plan. And obviously, he comes from a world that's very far from the news world and has not real understanding of what's going on.
So you are saying that essentially the same thing that we're going through here in the U.S. with uncertainty in media and newspapers folding, it's happening in France too. I'm also intrigued by the idea you just put out there of the investors, the shareholders in Libération kind of riding on the brand as opposed to investing in content. Is that also happening a lot in France?
The problem is that there is this idea that news is not making money anymore and you have to find the money elsewhere. So diversification is really the key word. So Le Figaro, a right-wing newspaper, is organizing cruises with journalists as speakers. We ourselves, in our website, we have created a wine fair. And so this is definitely happening. The strange thing in this case is that it's the only focus. And you know, if you're using that money to make the newspaper better or in investing in new ways of presenting the news, of new plans for mobile or for tablet, that's one thing. But that's not the case. Their plan is mainly focusing on the brand and making money with the brand outside journalism.
Libération is an interesting case as well. I mean, founded by Jean-Paul Sartre, it's been the moral light of French progressives for decades. What does this do to the direction of leftist politics in France if the journalists move to the suburbs and headquarters becomes a restaurant?
Well, it says a lot about the fate of journalism. It's true, but it also says a lot about the French society at the moment. It's true that the case has attracted a lot of attention in France because of the special place this newspaper has in its history. As you said, it goes back to Jean-Paul Sartre, to the May 68 revolution in France and the intellectual movement. And today, the newspaper is really the shadow of what it used to be, and its shareholders are really coming from a completely different world.
So I'm just curious how you feel about all these changes, these big changes that are happening in newspapers and how fast they're taking place.
The case of Libération is very sad because I think both sides are getting it wrong at the moment. On one side, you have the journalists who have failed to adapt to the digital challenge and who are now waking up to it. And on the other side, you have a shareholder who really is completely outside the scope of news and is trying to make money from other sources. So this is very sad.
May you live in interesting times, and indeed we do. Pierre Asky, thanks very much for speaking with us about this.
Thank you.
Former Libération editor Pierre Asky, now with online news outlet Rue 89. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World.
Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow than Mustang down.
It takes me back to 1991, and that'd be the year The Commitments came out with that killer soundtrack. It's the tale of Jimmy Rabbit, the young Irishman who had this crazy notion to put together an American soul band in, of all places, Dublin. The movie was based on a book by novelist Roddy Doyle.
It became a bit of a burden after a while, you know. You couldn't go anywhere without some twit singing Mustang Sally. You know? So it is almost true to say I forgot I wrote it, you know.
But Doyle did decide to revisit the life of Jimmy Rabbit. Jimmy is back and Doyle's latest book, The Guts. It follows Jimmy as he navigates the twin disasters of colon cancer and Ireland's ongoing economic crisis.
When the Irish economy collapsed, there was a lot of nostalgia, if such a thing is possible, nostalgic analysis of what was going on. People harping back to the 80s, and a lot of 80s music being played on radio, accompanied by economists explaining what the word recession meant. And I found it a bit offensive, really. Funny at first, but a bit offensive.
Why?
Because perhaps the radio producers and the economists had lived their glory days in the 1980s, but I was a teacher in a working-class area of Dublin in the 1980s, and they were nobody's glory days there. It was rough, you know. There was a lot of poverty and an unemployment rate that's almost science fictional. And it all got on my nerves, I've got to say, you know. And that's what drove me into the book, really. I wanted to see, I created those rabbit characters in the 1980s, and I thought, well, I'll add a quarter of a century to their lives and see how they're getting on in this new one.
It's a very serious kind of analysis that you give, but it is what happened. I'm just wondering, in that period where the Celtic tiger was really muscular, who was actually benefiting from that?
I think everybody to a degree, but particularly if you when you write about working class people, and you're never far from the fridge. You know what I mean? Because you need, yeah. You know, and I mean, you know, I've written about people who don't know if there's going to be anything in the fridge at the end of the week. And that, you know, if you like, for most people, that wasn't an issue. And so that anxiety, that fear was gone, or seemed to be gone.
But today that fear is back.
It is.
How about Jimmy Rabbit, our fictional Jimmy Rabbit? How did he fare during the Celtic Tiger boom years?
He did fine. I mean, he was a car salesman at first. He didn't like the job at all, but he did okay. You know, he could pay the mortgage. But then, kind of aided and abetted, nudged on by his wife, he formed this online music company. And that, I think, is where Celtic Tiger Jimmy comes in a good sense. You know, he becomes an entrepreneur. He uses his enthusiasm, you know, music. And so his love becomes his income. It becomes his living. And I think that would have been a great thing about the Celtic Tiger as well. I mean, when things started going wrong with the economy, there was an immediate condemnation of everything and everybody, you know. Oh, you know, flaying of our backs, what terrible people we are. We wasted it all. But no, an awful lot of people just opened these enterprises, and just something they thought they'd like to do. And because there was that bit of extra cash, people thought, well, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to buy that, or I'd like to eat that. So it was great, in actual fact, you know. So Jimmy would have been a beneficiary of this, I suppose. People, you know, curiously, they have their own laptops because they have extra money. They wonder, well, what happened to Screaming Yahoos, that band from 1976? And they look them up, and there's Jimmy offering both the two singles that they released online. And they've a bit of extra money, so they buy it. But of course, one of the first things to go when the extra money is gone is that type of buying.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a real kind of luxury, isn't it, to go nostalgia digging?
Yes. So that, you know, the anxiety arrives on Jimmy's doorstep.
Jimmy also, as I said, has colon cancer in this novel, and that's happening against the backdrop of this economic recession. Jimmy's dad is very solicitous of his son and his son's health, it seems. He wants to make sure he's eating right, but Jimmy kind of doesn't want to hear too much about his own illness. Tell us about their relationship and how it's grown over the years.
Well, it's a great relationship, really, you know. I grew up in I think it was Colm Tobin, the Irish novelist, said of my second novel, The Snapper, that it might be the first Irish novel ever to have a happy family, a functional family. And, you know, because you're supposed to be miserable, aren't you? You know, you're supposed to carry all this anger and misery, and I don't, really.
Was that your family? Did you have a happy family?
Ah, yeah, generally, yes, yeah. And certainly very functional, you know, a good family.
And a good relationship with your own father.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've gone through all the phases. I mean, when I was a teenager, I thought he was the biggest clown in Ireland, an absolute eejit. Then in my 20s, I began to
You just said absolute eejit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, well, okay, because that comes up a lot in the book. E-E-J-I-T, I think you spell it. Yeah. That would be idiot for our
It would, yeah. Except in Ireland, we tend not to bother with the extra syllable if at all possible. So, yeah, but over the years now, we've become, you know, good friends in a way. And with my mother, actually. So Jimmy is a bit like that, I suppose, and he's very lucky insofar as he can chat to his father, you know, and his father loves chatting to him. And Jimmy decides. Jimmy, I suppose I've never had cancer myself, so it's not autobiographical, but I would imagine having received a diagnosis, he just does not want to go into his own house with that news, with that word. He doesn't want to plonk it on the kitchen table and tell his wife or his young children. They're younger than my own children, for example. So he just doesn't want to do that. So his father is the first person he tells.
As you said, Jimmy's still into music. He's getting some traction with this website, CelticPunk.com. Where does this connection to music come from for you? I mean, it often plays a role in your stories.
I am a firm believer that music is almost like a channel or a thread right the way back to childhood. And I think this is a great thing. I was at an event in Washington and a reader asked me, you know, isn't Jimmy a bit immature? And I said that I really think maturity is overrated. Why can't there be an element of that enthusiastic? You know, why wouldn't it be a good thing? Listening to music, it's a constant reminder of what we were like, because we still are that person, you know. And I think it's almost a Victorian thing that, you know, childhood is one thing, a preparation for adulthood, and then you shut that door and you become an adult. I really like that continuity. And when I see my children now, they're huge. All three of them are huge music enthusiasts. And that makes me personally very happy, you know, that if I've nudged them in that direction, that's a terrific thing.
Roddy Doyle is the author of The Commitments, The Snapper, and The Van, among other novels, as well as the just-released fourth part of those stories, The Guts. Roddy, thanks very much for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Baby, here I am. I'm a man on the scene.
Yeah, it's not Mustang Sally, so I hope Mr. Doyle is cool with the selection. The American Delta, by way of Dublin, another track from The Commitments. Thank you, Jimmy Rabbit. You can hear Roddy Doyle reading a bit from his new novel, The Guts, at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Pretty little thing, let me light your candle, cause mama, I'm sure hard to handle now. Yes, I am.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.